I'm joined today by my brilliant colleague and dear friend, Dr. Leslie Black. We are chatting all about mold and how it impacts fertility in both women and men. She breaks down what toxic mold is, where it's found, how to test for it, and what to do about it. She has a wealth of knowledge, and I'm so excited that she's been able to share her expertise with us. Without further ado, let's get started. Welcome to Healthy as a Mother, the podcast for becoming and being a mother, with your co-hosts, Dr. Leah Gordon and Dr. Morgan McDermott, two naturopathic doctors who get it.
Each week, we teach you how to be the healthiest mother you can be, from fertility and preconception to pregnancy and birth prep, through postpartum and throughout motherhood, empowering you with the natural health guidance and education you're not getting elsewhere, so you can confidently navigate the broken system at large.
The real, the raw, the untalked about. And remember, this information is not intended to diagnose, treat, or manage any disease. Always consult with your doctor before making any changes. Do you have your heart set on starting a family and are eagerly preparing to begin trying within the year? Have you been actively trying to conceive for several months? Do you have a burning desire to optimize your chances of conception and avoid the distressing path of infertility? Or have you been navigating infertility for a while, yet you yearn for new solutions, a supportive environment, and an approach that addresses the root causes of infertility? Our current fertility system is broken. Many couples receive almost zero support on optimizing their health and improving their chances of conceiving before or while trying to have a baby. 1 in 7 couples end up trying for over a year and then are often shuttled into the medication or reproductive technologies route like IVF. Although there is a time and a place for these tools, so many couples would have different outcomes if they had the education, resources, and support I provide in my Fertility Formula program. This program is a step-by-step, doctor-designed, holistic fertility solution for the couple who wants to conceive optimally. And it includes everything a couple needs to know with all of the resources I've created over many years seeing patients in practice. From mastering the cycle to boosting egg and sperm quality, balancing hormones, investigating female and male fertility, having access to order your own labs, both hormones and functional medicine labs, nourishing the body with eating and managing that whole aspect, fostering fertility energy, ditching toxins, reducing stress, rebalancing the gut and vaginal microbiomes, and detoxing prior to pregnancy, this program has it all. On top of that, it includes the bonus modules of breaking up with birth control, optimizing IVF if that ever becomes needed, and my pregnancy loss guide. This is the holistic information and step-by-step guidance you aren't getting from your regular doctor that will only improve your chances of conception and the health of your future baby, no matter where you are along your fertility journey, or no matter what support you might need, whether that's getting pregnant naturally or going through IUI or IVF. Visit www.womanhoodwellness.com/fertilityformula and use code HEALTHYMOTHER to save 15% off the entire program. Again, that's www.womanhoodwellness.com/fertilityformula and use code HEALTHYMOTHER to save 15%. Dr. Leslie Black is a naturopathic doctor and graduate of Bastyr University, California. She has been trained as a primary care provider and specialist within the field of integrative medicine. Dr. Black centralizes her practice around empowering patients to take charge of their own health by educating them about prevention, wellness, nutrition, sustainable health, and lifelong vitality. She serves as a personal investigator in search of uncovering the root cause of your health concerns and provides naturopathic treatments and wellness plans tailored specifically for each individual according to their unique needs. Okay, Dr. Leslie, I am so excited to interview you today. You are such an expert in so many things and such a wealth of knowledge, and I have been anticipating interviewing you on this podcast for so long. Thank you and welcome, and I can't wait to chat all about mold.
Yes, thank you so much for having me. I'm very, very excited about talking about mold today, as most days.
Because mold is really something that stresses me out. I feel like you're the person that I always lean toward because it's a really big topic. It can be confusing and overwhelming, and I feel like it's something that is pervasive, yet very few people know about.
Yes,
which is absolutely unfortunate. So to get started, why don't you break down what mold even is? Because I think when people hear mold, it's like we don't even have context to wrap our mind around because a lot of people don't learn about it. Can you just explain what it is and the parts that are maybe not good for us? Can you just highlight that?
Yeah, absolutely. So mold is basically just a naturally occurring fungus. So, and it has a very specific purpose in our ecosystem. It's basically used to compost and recycle organic materials. So I think of it as like nature's kind of cleanup crew. You know, it's breaking down all the organic plant matter, animal matter, and recycling that, because otherwise we would just have a very polluted ecosystem. So it actually has a very important purpose. And because it's naturally occurring, it can really be found anywhere. So when I tell that to people, I'm like, yeah, mold can definitely be found inside your home. You know, it's going to be found outside your home. It's going to be found inside your home. But it really only becomes problematic when we have high levels indoors as opposed to outdoors, or maybe there's species growing inside that are not found outside. Because every time we open our door, our window, we go in and out of our homes, we are bringing in mold. And I know for some people it's like, what? I can't get away. But it is. Every time we open our doors, or, you know, these spores are clinging to our clothing and we're bringing it inside. And most of the time, those concentration levels of mold are really, really low. They're easy to manage. But when it's actively growing in our house, of course, those concentration levels increase. It doesn't have any type of competition from its natural environment. So it's going to lower the overall air quality and making us a little more susceptible to breathing it in. And that's really where we can start to have some problems, because some mold is very opportunistic and it can be related to very specific health conditions. And it can also produce something called mycotoxins, which we're going to be talking about today, and how those relate to, or there's impact on fertility. But mold does need a few specific things to help it grow. And I think that's important to know, because, you know, most of us think, okay, water. Yeah, we know water, that water is obviously needed for mold to grow, but it also needs a food source. So some sort of organic substrate. So whether that be the wood in our home, drywall, insulation, any of that. And it needs some sort of relative high humidity too. So very specific temperature, of course, and water. And this water does not need to be visible. So it can be splashing water, you know, against a wall next to the shower, or it could be a small leak in our pipe that we didn't know was there. Or in my instance, grout behind my backsplash that yep. was not sealed properly. I think you had a similar experience.
Yep, I did. Yep.
Yeah. So in all of those places that we may just not really think about. But the problem lies in the fact that some of those molds can grow within 24 to 48 hours. Wow. That's super fast. So if we don't know that there is a leak in a pipe somewhere, or we've splashed water on an unsealed backsplash, you know, it can grow mold so quickly.
Yeah.
So that's where it can become problematic. And I also just wanted to mention the different components really quick. I know we'll get into those later, but when I talk to patients, I say, you know, mold is not just mold. So it has a lot of components that are super fascinating. So it has spores, spore fragments, the mycotoxins, biofilms, chemicals, endotoxins,
wow.
so many things that can harm us for sure. So it's just a fascinating organism.
Yeah. So before we get into the details of mold, well, I guess first let's start with this section and then we'll go into another section, because I think it's confusing for people. You know, maybe they take their blueberries out of the fridge and they're fuzzy, or, yeah. you know, you see a mushroom or mold or something growing outside. How is like every mold toxic to us, or is there certain types? And when you're saying that they're growing inside, is every mold inside bad? And can you kind of break down what makes them bad and which ones are not?
Yeah, not all mold is toxic to us. I think really how I would look at this is the mold that's producing those mycotoxins are going to be the ones that we need to be most concerned about, because all of us probably have eaten mold at some point. If you've eaten aged cheese, you know, you've eaten mold. If you've eaten moldy blueberries, which we all have, and then we're like, oh, it tastes so bad. Mm-hmm. You know, or there's always going to be some level of mold growing in our homes. So we're constantly being exposed in one way or the other. And all of that, is it great for us? No, but is it going to cause a specific health condition? No, not always. But I think it's really those mycotoxins, that chemical byproduct that we really need to be most concerned about. And I will say too, you know, some people are not as susceptible to those than others. There is a genetic component to this as well, that 25% of the population have a genetic mutation that makes them a little more susceptible. We can have a whole podcast about that.
Is it like one gene, like one SNP that someone could test for, or is it more complicated than that?
It is something that we can test for. It's in the HLA gene family, and it is something that can be tested. But I'll tell you, just to be real honest, I don't really test my patients for that. Because I think if they have mold exposure, if they're having symptoms, then we're going to do something about it.
Right.
But this is a good question though, because I know I've actually had this happen many times where I've had maybe a husband or a wife or a mom and a child, and they're living in a home with other people, and they say, well, why am I having symptoms and they're not? You know, well, there could be a lot of reasons for that. There could be compromised immune system. There can be, again, this genetic susceptibility, other environmental factors that are impacting the person in a different way. So there's a lot of reasons why someone in the same household could be sick and why others are not.
Okay. So I had someone ask me this question the other day. I can't remember if it was a patient or if it was online, but they said, if I've been exposed to mold knowingly, yet I don't have symptoms, am I being negatively impacted? Is it only if there's symptoms? Like maybe they don't have the gene, we don't know.
Right.
But, you know, they've maybe done a mycotoxin test and have seen high mycotoxins, or they've known that they've had a mold exposure in the home, but they have no symptoms, no issues. Is that still bad? Or is it only negatively affecting you if you're showing symptoms?
Well, the thing with this too is we have to look at, okay, let's talk about the test. If they've tested and they have high levels of mycotoxins, we don't know if they're currently having an active exposure, you know, or if this has been a past exposure. Mm-hmm. You know, chronic exposure, we'll say, to something like mold can have negative health impacts along with symptoms. Usually there's symptoms. Could it be perpetuating inflammation, like underlying inflammation, possibly? Mm-hmm. You know, could there be an underlying autoimmune condition there that it's kind of adding fuel to the fire? Maybe.
Yeah.
You know, so it really does depend on the person, you know, and how their body is reacting to that. Is the immune system doing a good job at keeping that exposure at bay?
Yeah.
You know? And, okay. And not everybody will manifest symptoms right away. I mean, it could be years from now. Because we mm-hmm. know that, for instance, if we're exposed to mold and it has released its spores into the air and its spore fragments into the air, those will stay suspended in the air forever, because gravity is not strong enough to pull those down. So it's constantly in our breathing zone. Wow. So long-term exposure to that, let's say it's in their home, could it have impacts over time? Yeah. It could, but they may not be showing up at mm-hmm. this particular stage.
Okay. So that's a good question and segue us into the fertility conversation.
Yeah.
Because, you know, when people are either thinking about conceiving, whether they have symptoms or not, you know, we would love for people to be as healthy as possible. And mold might be a factor in that, or in someone maybe who's been trying to conceive for a while and they're not having success. And I know in my practice, you know, mold comes up sometimes, which I always hate when it does. I'm like, oh, this might be a factor. But can you tell us kind of about how mold could potentially impact fertility and why someone might want this on their radar?
Sure. I'm going to talk about some specific organisms because those are the ones that we have research on.
Okay.
And when we say mold, I'm going to be talking about the mycotoxin, because again, this is where that's that area of research that we have that we can see impacts on different health conditions as well as fertility.
Yeah.
And again, mycotoxin itself
is a toxic byproduct of certain types of mold. Not all types of mold produce a mycotoxin. The reason that this mycotoxin is produced in the first place is because mold feels threatened in some way. So maybe another mold organism or microbe is encroaching on its space, encroaching on its food source. So it spits out this chemical that covers the entire colony to say, hey, back off. This is my area.
Oh, geez.
Yeah. And the crazy part is wild. And so the thing that we have to keep in mind is if a mold has produced their spores, its spore fragments, and has produced a mycotoxin, it's now aerosolized in the air. There is no safe upper limit that the body can handle of a mycotoxin.
Okay.
That's what we need to keep in mind. There's no safe upper limit. And these toxins are going to be stored in fat cells or fatty tissue. The other thing, it's going to, you know, it can cross the blood-brain barrier. It can dysregulate the immune system. It can affect reproduction, and it can cross into the placenta. Okay. So that's where if someone is thinking about conceiving, this is important. Because we have mycotoxins on board, they're so small, they can cross into the placenta and potentially harm our fetus. So yeah, it's definitely something that to keep in mind. So the mycotoxins that we have research on are the ones I'll highlight today. And I'm going to provide you with those research studies mm-hmm. too, so you have those. But the first one that I'm going to talk about is called chaetoglobsin. And this is a mycotoxin, secondary metabolite from a mold called chaetomium. And this is one that's most commonly found in a water-damaged building, water-damaged home. Okay. But it also can be found in food sources. So things like corn, grapes, apple juice, cherry juice. So those are kind of the common sources. And it's very, very toxic, even in very small amounts.
Okay.
So this is definitely one to keep on your radar. Its main method of action in fertility is on the male, because it can cause male infertility due to spermatocyte degeneration. So it can basically disintegrate the sperm.
Oh my gosh.
Right. Right. So yeah, so this is important. So this is one that we talk about, male factor infertility, for instance. Mm-hmm. Is it a standalone cause? No. But could it be a component? Yes. So in this particular study, there were mice that were injected with a very small amount of this toxin. And within 12 hours, all of the spermatocytes were degenerated. All of them were broken down. And you could actually visibly see shrinkage in the testicles of the mice. So that was pretty wild. It's pretty
wild. So if someone were being exposed to this, then it would show up as low count, or would it show up as like a DNA fragmentation issue?
So from this research study, it's a DNA fragmentation issue.
Okay. So a person, like a man, could do a semen analysis and maybe the count is normal, but their actual sperm are being broken down, which is where maybe a DNA fragmentation test would be helpful to see.
Would be helpful. Yeah. Would be helpful.
Okay. Fascinating. Mm-hmm. Oh my gosh. That's crazy.
It is crazy. It's a crazy one.
Yeah.
And then the next one is called citrinin. And this is also a mycotoxin that's commonly found in grains. It's also found in beer. Fruits and vegetable juices, unfortunately, infant formula, olives, apples, and the supplement red yeast rice. So that's why it's important to test the red yeast rice supplement if you're using that, and also water damaged buildings. And the research shows with this one, its main method of action in terms of fertility is it inhibits oocyte maturation. So basically, it's causing early apoptosis or early death of the oocyte.
Okay. And the oocyte is the eggs, for people who don't know, female eggs in the ovaries.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes. So it affects the early embryo development basically because as it's basically causing a lot of oxidative stress in the body and on the embryo itself. So then we're seeing things, possible miscarriage, possible issues with conception there. And so that's, again, this was in a mouse study, but it is one to keep on our radar as well, because this is where if we're having trouble actually conceiving, this might be one that we look at.
Have they done any studies? I mean, I'm sure this is so infant in its, you know, study development world, but have they done any looking at premature ovarian insufficiency, basically women who have a lower than normal egg count for their age and mold exposure, because it's basically like their eggs are not there. There's not as many as there should be.
I don't know of any current research on that. There could be that I haven't seen, but I think that would be an amazing study to do to see if it does have some bearing on that or correlation, you know, causative correlation would be something that would be interesting to see.
Or even PCOS, because if it affects the oocyte development, right? Sometimes women with PCOS have a hard time with that normal maturation of the egg, right? Yep. So it delays, and that's why they have all of these little follicles and why their ovulation is delayed and they have irregular cycles. So I know that other toxins are very implicated in PCOS and are starting to be shown in premature ovarian insufficiency. It makes sense that mold is just another one of those toxins that would play a role.
Absolutely. I think it could definitely be put into that category. This area of research, obviously, we need lots more.
Yeah,
we need a lot more research, you know, and also just human studies, you know, rather than just the mouse studies. So yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Oh my gosh, that's so crazy. So are there any others that they've studied that you know of, or is that those are the main two?
Yes. So I always butcher this name. So
it's okay.
Dicetoxyscriptinol is another one.
Wow, that sounds way better than what I could have done.
I'm probably going to butcher that. I do it every time. It's actually, so it's abbreviated DAS because most of us can't pronounce it. But this is from a group A trichothiazine, a group of molds. This one is also found in grains or water damaged buildings. This one also impacts male fertility due to its basically direct toxic effects on the testes.
Wow.
And in this particular study, when they were given an injection of this toxin, a very small amount, what they saw quickly after the injection were these small fluid-filled cysts that developed on the testes.
Oh,
yeah.
Weird.
Yeah. So this actually was done in a study on birds, boiler breeds, or what they were called. But so they did see toxic effects there on the testes themselves. And then this basically manifestation of these fluid filled cysts that were considered toxic. So that's another one.
Wow.
Anatinin is another one as well from the Fusarium fungus. And this is found in things like cereals, peaches, apples, pears, potatoes, peanuts, peas, asparagus, and tomatoes. This one's main method of action on fertility was its cytotoxic effects on pre- and post-implanted embryos. So again, pre-implantation and post-implantation, it's basically inducing intracellular stress, and it's immunotoxic to the fetus itself, so basically impairing development of the embryo. From the zygote stage all the way to the blastocystic stage, so all the way from the very beginning. So that's another one.
Mm-hmm.
And let's see, I have a few
more. What about black mold? So a lot of people are told, you know, black mold is like the worst mold. And even though there's like, I know there's nuances, there are some molds like Aspergillus, I think, that can appear black. Stachybotrys is typically the species that people refer to with black mold. Have they done any looking on that with fertility, or it just hasn't been studied yet?
Stachybotrys is that one that's mentioned here. It is in the trichothiazine family, though, so it does have some effects on fertility. Chaetomium actually is one of those that is also a black mold. So that's the one we first mentioned. So that one, you know, as we know, Stachybotrys, there could be some studies out there specific to fertility, but I'm not sure. Yeah.
And just because there hasn't been a study doesn't mean it's not affecting people.
Correct. Oh, yeah. Okay. It affects your body in many different ways. Yeah. Many ways that could eventually – it can affect, you know, hormone production for sure, because it's affecting our endocrine system. So, yes, it can.
Yeah.
In a roundabout way, yes.
Crazy.
Yes, for sure. And then So there's a couple more if you want me to mention these that are going to be that.
Yeah. Maybe just make mention the name of the mycotoxin. So if someone ever does a test, they kind of know roughly.
Yeah. So zearalenone is another one. And this actually can affect both genders. So this is one that we can see more of an estrogen dominance picture. Ooh. So it's an estrogenic mycotoxin. So this is one that does impact estrogen and poor estrogen metabolism. It can also affect the male testes as well.
Wow.
So in that respect, it's going to induce what's called testicular germ cell depletion. So again, DNA fragmentation there and testicular atrophy. So wow. That's another one. So this one also affects puberty in children. So early puberty is something that we see with children. So I just thought I'd make mention of that because it's kind of interesting.
Yeah.
Yep. And there's a couple more here. Ochratoxin is another one that can affect that. Birth defects are the biggest one that we're seeing with that. And this one wasn't a human study. And it was from women in their first 24 hours of postpartum. And they found high levels of ochratoxin. This one is teratogenic and mutagenic. It's very, very neurotoxic to males. And so this one is being studied as a possible correlation to autism in males.
Oh, wow. That's crazy. Oh, my goodness. And what species does that one come from?
So the ochratoxin is the one that I'm talking about right now, is the mycotoxin from Aspergillus.
Aspergillus. Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. Oh, I've been exposed to Aspergillus.
I think most of us have at some
point. Right before I got pregnant. Lovely.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. My goodness.
Yeah, Aspergillus. I mean, it's such a common indoor mold, and mold that's on food too. So it's really hard to avoid this one completely. But again, we're talking about, you know, higher levels and it kind of growing without any type of natural competitor.
I mean, I think the main exposure I had was I had a bag of soil that was outside. This was in San Diego and I had opened it, but then I like rolled it down and it was just outside and it rained and I left it and it was, I don't know, in the warmer months. So it had been probably not even a couple days. And I went to go plant a pot and I opened it up and the entire top, I can't even tell you, it was like 4-inch high hyphae of the mold.
Yeah.
And at first I was like, oh, well, this is just dirt. And so it surely isn't toxic or harmful, you know, because it's like in dirt. But I realized after the fact, or maybe I talked to you and you told me that it was still in an enclosed environment because it was in a plastic bag.
Right.
That had trapped moisture and that didn't simulate nature. And because I felt so bad and my daughter was with me and I remember making the comment a day before that she had no dark circles under her eyes. And I've always had dark circles under my eyes. And I think a lot of it has been mold exposure. Probably when I was a kid too, our basement flooded all the time and like, you know, all the things. And I made the comment looking at her, I'm like, wow, you have no dark circles under your eyes. And she was with me the day we were doing this gardening thing. And I had a horrible reaction. And then I just noticed for that whole next week and a half for her, she looked like she'd been punched in the eyes.
Oh, yeah.
And I was like, oh my gosh, you know, and I eventually did a mycotoxin test and my aspergillus was really high. And who knows if it was from something else, but I'm sure that that's what it was. Cause I think the aspergillus is a common white mold that grows in soil, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah, so that was a bummer.
It is, yes. But you're right. I mean, that is, you know, an acute exposure to a toxic mold and the types of symptoms that you were experiencing can be very, very common with an acute exposure.
Yeah. And I think I actually have an allergy to mold separate from having issues with mycotoxin because I have the symptoms of allergy-like symptoms, you know, difficulty breathing, coughing, you know, sneezing, runny nose, feeling really weird. And then I get really dizzy around mold and people are like, can you come to my house? Because I can just feel when there's mold, I feel terrible. I feel super dizzy. I feel really bad. And my sister has almost died a couple times from really bad toxic mold exposure. And I'm pretty sure she did the genetic testing and she does have the genes. So most likely I do too, that make it a bummer. So that's so fascinating. And you know, this can be super scary. Are there any other things around fertility before we move on to my next question? Because I want to make sure we
wrap. Yeah, I mean, there's, you know, another, I mean, there's just to keep in mind, there's over 300, 400 mycotoxins out there.
So many of them affect fertility, basically.
Many of them can affect fertility for sure. But we have, you know, research on a few and the testing that we have, I think the most that we can test is 29 different mycotoxins right now. Wow. So yes, botulinum would be another one that I would look at, again, from Aspergillus and Penicillium. And this one is one of those that kind of indirectly can impact that because it's teratogenic and mutagenic. And this is the one that can alter chromosomes and it causes DNA damage. So yes, it can. It can impact.
Wow.
Yeah.
So with that, this can feel so scary to people. And obviously, as with many things in the fertility space, people look around and they're like, well, everyone else seems to be getting pregnant, you know, and
yeah,
are they exposed to mold? Like, what's going on? I mean, how can you help someone understand if they have a problem, if it's something they need to look into? And then a little bit later in the episode, we'll talk about maybe steps to take, you know, to help ourselves either get rid of the mold or remediate or whatever. So if someone's listening to this, I mean, it kind of can feel like, okay, well, if there's mold everywhere, I mean, how do I know if there's a problem? Are there certain symptoms someone would be feeling, or is there a test they should do, or how does, what do you recommend?
Let's take a quick break to hear a word from our sponsors. Did you know that 97% of women in the US take a prenatal supplement, yet 95% plus are still deficient in key nutrients? My favorite prenatal is from a company called Needed because they dose nutrients at levels to not just meet the bare minimum as most prenatals do. They actually use form of nutrients and dosages that allow mama and baby to thrive. Needed actually approached me years ago and asked me if I could help them design the perfect prenatal because they knew that the current prenatals available were not actually helping women. We spent over 3 years diving into the research and understanding what practitioners are seeing and what women actually need at this important season before we formulated this amazingly supportive option. It's no wonder over 4,000 practitioners now recommend Needed, something I am very proud of. If you have followed me for a while, you know that prenatals and optimizing nutrients starts long before pregnancy. So no matter where you are along your fertility or motherhood journey, Needed is the brand I recommend. Head to thisisneeded.com and use code HEALTHYMOTHER to save 20% on your first order. Again, visit thisisneeded.com and use code HEALTHYMOTHER to save 20%.
Okay, back to the show.
Well, again, I would say looking at this as a possible component, you know, to something like if they're struggling with fertility. Is it, again, a standalone cause? No, I don't think so. I don't think there's any way for us to ever prove that, yes, this is the one thing that's causing that. But I guess for me, clinically, what I see most of the time, if I have patients that are struggling with fertility or just are coming in because they're having kind of strange myriad of symptoms, then that is something that we do need to look at. So some of the most common things that I see usually are things like chronic fatigue, I mean, extreme fatigue, just feeling, oftentimes people will tell me, I don't feel like I have energy to get out of bed. Of course, that can be many other things, but that's a big symptom to think about whenever someone says that. We see things like joint pain, issues with cognitive, like a cognitive impairment, like brain fog, trouble concentrating or finding the right word. I, like you, experience when I walk into a room with mold, even if you can't see any mold, I have that exact, I can't speak. I literally cannot get the words out. So that can be acute or chronic. So sensitivity to light touch, headaches, sensitivity to bright lights. A lot of people will have chronic sinusitis, so chronic sinus symptoms that they just can't seem to get rid of. Maybe they've taken a course of antibiotics or several courses of antibiotics, and nothing seems to, you know, change anything in the sinuses. Abdominal pain, gastrointestinal issues is another one that I see. Depression and anxiety, mood swings, appetite swings, hormonal dysregulation. So we see issues with estrogen, progesterone, testosterone, food sensitivities, weight gain or weight loss. And another one that's kind of interesting is this metallic taste in their mouth. Not everybody will have that, but I have seen that.
Interesting. Oh my goodness. Yeah. So if someone is on the path to wanting to conceive or trying, or maybe they have already had kids and they are worried about their little kids, you know, being in mold, what are typically the first steps that you recommend someone do? Do they test their home? Do they test their body? What do you recommend?
So it does depend on the circumstance. So what I mean by that is, let's say you have a family that's living in a home, maybe they're renting, you know, maybe they're renting a home and their children start having symptoms, or they start having symptoms and they suspect mold. So you can test the body and test the living environment if you'd like to, or some people will just say, hey, we're just going to get out of here. You know, if they're renting a home, they can easily just vacate and see if symptoms improve or not. If they own the home, that might be a little bit different. So in that respect, what I often will do is have the person test their body as well as test the home. So do both things. And there's different ways in which you can do that. And I also want to preface this by saying, though, this is just one tool that we use. It's not the only diagnostic tool that we use, you know, to verify if mold is really the issue. It can point us in a certain direction, but there's a lot of issues, we'll say, with mycotoxin testing. A lot of differences in labs, a lot of variables that can affect testing, but it can be helpful if we're trying to, if a person is having certain symptoms and we say, hey, you know what, this could be associated with a certain mold, maybe we should look at that. And do those symptoms line up with what we're finding on a test? So in that respect, I would test. Okay.
And that's like a urine test, the mycotoxin.
Yeah, urine mycotoxin testing is what I use. And I can talk to you about, you know, different labs and things like that if you want.
Yeah. And I just want to piggyback on, you mentioned a lot of symptoms, but I know personally in my life, I've had a couple friends whose children have shown neurodevelopmental issues.
Yeah.
And, you know, they've gone down the route of like, do they have autism? Like, what's going on? Like, and then they discover that it's mold. They have mold in their house and have gotten them out of that situation, and their, you know, cognitive development and their neurodevelopment starts to blossom. Mm-hmm. So I say that in case there's someone maybe that has an older child already that's showing issues, potentially investigating the mold before you have another baby, or even if you've had all your children, to help just their development in general.
Yes.
So, and also I think you probably mentioned this, but just people who just seem sick all the time. You know, they're always catching the cold. They're always just sniffles. And and some people will use that excuse, because I've had a lot of personal people in my life exposed to mold. I'm like, does everybody have this much mold, or is it just my family that has it? And, you know, kids get sick. I get it. They're at school and it feels like they're always sick. But I feel like there's another level where it's like, this isn't normal. This is just, you can't always be sick. That's weird.
Absolutely. I mean, I have friends right now that have the same issue too. And that's where that, you know, if there's been long-term exposure, you know, to mold, we do start to see the breakdown of the immune system, or basically the immune system having trouble keeping up, doing its job, you know, to fight the mold. And so we will start to see frequent infections. Just feeling tired, or just they catch every little thing that they come across. And in that respect, maybe testing would be a good thing to actually see if they do have mold on board.
Now, is there ever a situation where someone would do a urine mycotoxin test? For example, I'm thinking of one person in particular who I know they've been living in mold, a kiddo, did a test and it came back with nothing.
Yes. Yeah.
Tell us about that, because I think that really threw the family for a loop until they actually tore their house down and found all the mold.
Found the mold, yeah.
And it's like, what is that all about?
Right. A lot of variables with this one. A lot of variables with this question. So firstly is the type of test that was used. Because some people will do serum testing or blood testing. Some people will do urine testing. But keep in mind that every single lab that offers urine testing has different parameters. Some labs are using a population control. So they have they basically test against a healthy population. And some labs don't have any reference frame or don't have any type of population that they're testing against. So number one, it depends on the test. I'll put it out there with that. It depends on, was the sample collected appropriately? Was it delivered to the lab in a timely manner so that they could measure, you know, those analytes? And then, you know, it also depends on the type of test too, because if the child was really dehydrated or if their urine was really diluted, does the test actually account for that? So now we're looking at the way in which a lab measures a sample. So we're talking about, you know, environmental factors or collection factors, plus looking at how the lab is actually analyzing the sample. What the child's being exposed to in the current environment, what's their diet, or were they using any type of supplements that were detoxing? You know, those are all factors that you have to take into consideration when you have a negative test, if you know that the person is actively living in mold.
Yeah. So, yeah. And I don't know if it's similar. I know with other toxin tests, it's tricky. It's not very helpful to test in blood a lot of the time. We use urine for a lot of toxin tests. Yeah. But I know, at least in the adult world, that sometimes if people don't detox well, they actually can't get things out of their body very well. So their levels in urine actually look lower than they are in reality because they can't actually get them out of their body.
Right.
So sometimes the sickest people who are having the most issues sometimes will show up showing that it's not that big of a deal on the test. And that can be very confusing too.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. If they're having trouble detoxing at all in general, and they may be very low levels or below detectable limit on the test. So the test will be reported as negative, like that there's no mold on board. So yeah, absolutely. That can happen.
So, okay. Let's say someone tests their urine mycotoxin. Let's say it comes back positive. Now, what's the next step, especially if someone's looking around their house? And I see this a lot in California in particular, except I've talked to so many people across the country, and it just feels like anywhere that's humid-ish. And then really even here in Idaho, mold is a big problem because of new builds, how they build the homes, if they were building during the rain or the snow. And it's like you can look around and be like, this house looks perfect, yet there's mold hidden. Yeah. How does one even go about that? It can feel so overwhelming. What do you recommend?
So, there's so many factors to that too. So
here's a question that you can answer in a novel that you'll write one day.
But circling back to one of the things you just said, because I think it's interesting, wanted to bring up that I have a lot of people who say, well, I live in a new build, you know, so there shouldn't be mold, right? So we're now so focused on energy efficiency that these new builds are basically being built tighter, we'll say. So it's not allowing natural airflow to come in and out of the house. So now we're keeping compromised air that is polluted inside of the house. And we're inside of our homes, you know, what is it, 70% of the time, you know, maybe more than that. So now we're having all this polluted air just being contained inside the home because everything is just being built so much tighter, energy efficient. And so we're constantly being exposed to that. And some of the construction material, as you say, can be already harboring mold. So I would tell people if they could stay away from a new build, do. That's one thing I would say. Another thing would be if it's something that you, if mold is something you suspect in your home, you can test your home. You can test it yourself. There's ways I can, you know, tell you about some tests or link those tests here.
Yeah. What are your favorites? Well, let's back up to the mycotoxin. Do you have any favorites of labs that you trust?
Yeah. So urine mycotoxin testing is what I do usually if we're going to test. And there's two companies that I pretty much use exclusively now. One is the mycotoxin urine test from Mosaic Diagnostics, which used to be Great Plains. And then Vibrant America's mycotoxin testing as well. But again, I want you to keep in mind that all of these tests, you know, have their flaws for sure. And we're using it just kind of to point us in a certain direction, not as a standalone diagnostic tool. The mycotoxin urine testing from Mosaic tests for 11 different mycotoxins, and then the one from Vibrant tests for 29. So okay. You know, you have a big difference there, but based upon clinical symptoms, a thorough health history, a physical exam, a history of when they possibly had an exposure, all of that's really important to mm-hmm. determine which test you're going to use.
Gotcha. And then for testing the home, I know this is super controversial, and I have one friend she's dove so deep into it, and she probably knows more than most experts because she has one of those children who has neurodevelopmental issues, and she's discovered mold. And I know she has her own thoughts about testing. She goes into homes, they're looking for homes, and she does the ERMI test. So I don't know what your thoughts are on the ERMI test.
No, the ERMI test is great. And I think most environmental professionals, you know, that's one that they do recommend for sure. ERMI testing is great. And that's, again, one you can order on your own. I personally like the EMA test because it combines the mycotoxin with the ERMI. So, because the ERMI is actually only looking at mold. So this is the one that based upon kind of the EPA's recommendation, and it looks at I think it's 36 most common molds, and it splits them into two different groups, basically indoor and outdoor. And so that's, you're looking at mold species, quantity and species, you know, in that particular test, but it doesn't test for mycotoxins. That's the only, that's the big difference there.
Could it show as a lot of positives when there's not actually toxic mold?
Well, it can show us if there's mold present, but it doesn't show us what it doesn't show us is if that mold's producing mycotoxins.
Gotcha.
So if there's mold present without knowing if there's mycotoxins, or you do a test that shows that there's no mycotoxins, that treatment plan or plan of action will look very different from someone that has both mold and mycotoxins present.
Gotcha.
So I think that's why it's important to kind of test both of those things, because if it's mold standalone by itself, there can be maybe an easy remediation, or treatment plan may look different, or, you know, it depends. So ERMI testing is great for, hey, do I have mold here? But do I also have mycotoxins? I think that's important to me as a practitioner, because again, most of the people that I'm working with are chronically ill, or they've have a lot of symptoms. And so we kind of need to know if there's mycotoxins there.
I know I've had patients in the past where we've suspected mold, we've tested mycotoxins, they're high, they're positive, and they will hire a company to come out and look for mold, and they find nothing. And then they'll hire a different company that comes out, and then they find mold. So why, what is the situation? Like, can you break that down for us and kind of help us decide, as a person who's listening to this, what do you look for in a company that's going to come test, or what you should test yourself? Because clearly there's variation, and that's very frustrating.
So much variation. I have a handout.
Perfect.
I have a handout that you can put on this podcast.
Perfect.
Because this could be a whole podcast in itself, but there is a lot of variation between mold inspectors.
Yes.
And to tell you the truth, the sad part about this is there's not very many mold inspectors that are appropriately trained to do the full gamut of testing that really needs to be done. Because what I see is I have a patient come in and say, okay, well, they went in and they collected a couple air samples.
Yep.
Cool. Okay, well, if you're collecting an air sample in a room, you have to leave the room. So now there's no spores floating around, really, because there's no movement. And you're collecting air samples, you may or may not get anything in there. And it's such a snapshot in time. Air sampling can be great in certain circumstances, but it needs to be used in the appropriate circumstance. Same thing with like agar plates, you know, growing bacteria on a plate. Same thing. It only shows us a small picture, you know, of what we're going, of what we're looking for. And we know that mold harbors itself in dust. So that's what we need to be looking at too. So if we could do all of those things, the air sampling, plating, dust sampling, that would be great. That's what we need to do, you know, a complete picture. But the handout that I have there will kind of help you find, or questions to ask a mold inspector. You know, if they can't answer those questions, or if they don't know some of the things that you're talking about, move on, you know, to the next one. Because you need to find somebody that understands the testing that needs to take place for them to actually look to really find the issue.
Yeah. Perfect. I'm so glad you have that resource. I'll definitely include that. And I know for some people, I just want to give an anecdotal story. I think people really connect with stories, and you can share some of your own too. So, you know, my sister lived in an apartment in San Diego that was really close to the ocean. And I told her right away when I walked in, I'm like, something's wrong here, because I could just smell it. I felt weird and off. And they had, the apartment building had a leaking roof that was coming down behind her wall. So it wasn't until they had a huge rainstorm that all of the spores became activated that were already in her apartment. Yep. And it looked like someone had puffed powdered sugar everywhere. And, but you know, it wasn't like she had a flood. It wasn't, you know, so this is just like one example. Another example is another time she lived in a very fancy, very nice home in Montana. And they didn't realize that there was Stachybotrys growing in the garage on the wall that was kind of hidden behind an area. I had mold growing behind shower grout from compromised grout. So if you have broken grout in your shower, water can get behind there and be growing on the wall behind the grout. The only reason we knew that was because our tiles were see-through. They had chosen glass tiles. Otherwise, think about how many people have mold growing behind their shower. So these are some of the places to think about. My husband hung a mirror here at our new house, our new build, which we tested for mold before we moved in. And supposedly there is nothing found. Who knows? And he unknowingly punctured a hole in a water pipe because right next to the wall, midline on the wall, right where he hung the mirror. And it was probably 6 months of a slow, teeny tiny weeping drip of water that was trickling down. And the only reason I saw it was because the baseboard started to look gray. And I'm a super detail-oriented person. And I would have like noticed that when we moved in. I'm like, honey, has that always been gray? You know? And we don't mess around with mold anymore because it's really impacted our family in a really huge way. So we had an inspector come out. They're like, I don't know. I don't really know. It wasn't until we took the baseboard off and cut a hole in the wall that we found the leak. And mold had been starting to grow. It wasn't crazy, but think about if that had been left for 5 years, 10 years.
Yes.
So I just want people, and then I have another person in my life who was having a lot of mold exposure, and they ended up actually tearing their whole house down to the studs because they've had so many health issues, and they had mold behind their oven range, and there was mold on the wall that was coming from the sprinklers outside, and there was it can be hidden in places that you don't necessarily think about. And this is kind of where it becomes overwhelming. So what do you tell someone who's maybe just panicking, you know, thinking, where could this mold be coming from? I mean, what do you do to, how do we find this happy medium between knowing that this is important, it could be impacting fertility or my children, but also not, you know, having a panic attack and, you know, I don't even know, how do you handle this in between?
Well, I think knowing that there's going to be some level of mold in, you know, in any house that you're in. And that's just not, that's just going to happen because like I said, it comes from outside, inside. And, I think that if it's something that you suspect, or if it's something that you're concerned about and you are currently living in a home, having a professional come out that knows how to appropriately test to look for sources. You know, and I think I also have that in the handout there, some common sources. So look for, you know, sources that could be potential sources for mold. To keep in mind too, the HVAC system is usually a big one, because that there's that cross contamination, that can happen from a source into the HVAC system. So you can have somebody come look at the HVAC system. You know, they need to thoroughly investigate, looking at the ductwork, looking at the coils, you know, actually physically getting inside the unit itself. Is there insulation in that HVAC unit? If there is, maybe you take that insulation out, you know, cause that can harbor dust and spores and things like that. So if it is a concern, there are people that can come and they can help you say, okay, this could be a potential source. Let's look here. Let's look here. Let's look here and investigate. Air sampling can be done behind walls, you know, if that's something that you're concerned about. Most of the time, the people that I have that test already have symptoms, you know, they're already struggling. Or there's, maybe they have, you know, concomitant infections, you know, maybe they already have things on board that are causing some issues. And then they're like, well, maybe mold could be making this worse. So then we test and that kind of thing. So I'd say the majority of time people are showing some signs and symptoms. But if it is like, hey, I just want to investigate and make sure. So if they're moving into a new home, do a mold inspection. So the, your home inspector is not a mold inspector.
No.
Right. So if you're doing
they won't know.
They will not know. you know, they have the best intentions, of course, at looking at things. But in the new house that we just moved into, we had our inspector come out and he noticed in the crawl space that there was some old water damage from the dishwasher that had been leaking. And his response was, when we asked, is it mold? Is there mold? I can't tell you if there's mold, but you could call a mold inspector. Yes, you can call a mold inspector. And that handout that I have there can help you evaluate a mold inspector and help you have questions that you can ask them. And they can come look at it and say, okay, is there an issue here? You know, does there need to be further investigation? Does there need to be remediation and things like that? So that's if you're moving into a home. If you already live in a home, you can, like I said, you can have a professional come out and look and take a look. You can do testing yourself if you want to do just a preliminary test by using an Emma test, just to investigate that a little bit. But as much as like I'm obsessed with mold, and if there's mold anywhere in my home. But there are a lot of things that we can do to kind of prevent, you know, the growth of mold by just doing simple steps to kind of think about, okay, what can I do to kind of lower that, you know, just its ability to grow, I'll say.
Okay. Yeah. So, tell us these. This is great.
And these are things that I have learned over time and also just have done myself so that in an obsessive way, I will say, but you do not need to get this obsessive. It's just, it's a list of things that you can do to kind of help that process.
Okay.
But one of the things that you can do is drain and unclog your HVAC unit. So that, I didn't know about this, but you're supposed to drain and unclog it every year.
Wow.
So didn't know about that because a lot of gunk can build up in the bottom of it and then that can cause an issue or a leak. So that's one thing that you can do. That's something you can do on your own. Changing the filters in your house, you know, that the your vent, you know, those every 3 months would be a good one just to kind of keep the dust down, the ability of those possible spores, you know, to be collected and removed from the home. Cleaning the HVAC unit regularly too. I'm going to do mine once a year. I had a company come out that was certified from a national agency. I can put that link here too, that they look for mold in the HVAC unit. So you can do that. And dust, dust your home as much as you can, because that's where that mold lives. So if you can move your furniture away from the walls, dusting, you know, frequently will help reduce that possible exposure. Carpet is another one that can harbor dust and you know, all that. So if you can remove the carpet, I had almost all carpet in this house when we moved in.
Yeah.
White carpet, nonetheless. And I ripped everything out and put hardwood down.
Yeah.
So,
and what about like HEPA filters? Do those help with mold?
They do. That's another one that you can do too. The HEPA filter is a good one. I like things like IQ Air, Air Free, Austin Air. You know, those are also good air purifying systems. If you have a vacuum that has like a HEPA filter on it, that's also a plus that you can use as well. And then also, I'm getting ready to install this in my house, but there's a HEPA filter, a filtering system that you can actually put on your whole home.
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah.
Pretty cool. I want that information.
And I can provide that link too, because like you, I was like, wow, I just would like a whole house HEPA filter system.
Yeah.
You know, because wouldn't it be easier than running machines all the time, you know, in every room of the house?
I would love that information.
That exists. So IQ Air is the one that I'm going to be using myself. And so you can have that installed in your home. So that's a whole house HEPA filter system. So that's a good one. And just controlling moisture, you know, and using like a dehumidifier if the moisture level gets above 50%, humidity level.
So humidity above 50% is when mold can grow. Okay. I have two questions. I know we're kind of coming up on the hour. What about houseplants? Because it's like sometimes I look at my plants and there's white film on the dirt. And I'm like, do I need to throw this away?
This is a really good one.
Or is because I've heard that plants can help, but do they also hurt? Like, tell us about plants, because I love plants and I want to know.
I love plants too. So I will say this, like, just to give you an example. I have some patients that are very, very sensitive, to mold. And they happen to have a lot of houseplants. Mm-hmm. And there was mold growing on those houseplants. So I did recommend in that circumstance to get rid of the houseplants, because it can be a source of mold, as much as we love plants. And yes, they can help. They can help purify the air for sure. But they can also be an exposure to mold. So I think it does depend on the person.
So is it just if you see like white mold growing on the dirt that that's a problem, or any houseplants are going to have mold?
There's going to be mold growing in the soil. That's just something that's going to happen. It is just going to happen. We know that mold, fungus, bacteria, all of that lives in that soil, and we're adding moisture to that soil. So this could be naturally occurring. But for some people, even that minute amount can be too much exposure. Gotcha. So in that respect, I would say to that person, maybe we remove the house plants. I'm not saying that to everyone, because not everybody is in that circumstance. But if they are very, very sensitive, that might be an option.
Because I feel like I'm very sensitive in the sense that at least when I've walked into places where I feel like there is bad mold, I feel bad. Yet I have quite a few house plants and I don't feel terrible. But I have thrown away certain houseplants that I'm like, this makes me feel kind of weird. So I kind of pick and choose.
Yeah. And you, like you said, you know, you have an immediate reaction when you're exposed to mold. So if you're next to a houseplant that you start getting a headache or dizzy or having those symptoms, then I think you kind of can say, maybe this one needs to go.
Yeah.
In that respect. But I think they can be very, very helpful in others. So I wouldn't tell anybody, hey, just go throw all your houseplants away.
Right.
It's very individualized.
But if you have been exposed to mold, this is one thing we haven't touched on. Let's say you've lived in a house, you know it has mold exposure, and you're going to try to move. We don't want to bring all of our stuff with us to the next house, right?
I have a guide for this too. Handout for this. There's so much information on this. So yes, this is true. So this is so much. This is such a big topic.
I know.
If there are, I kind of can kind of break it down a little bit, but if there are items that are highly porous, and we'll say it also depends on too, are they sentimental items? Are there items that you can just discard and easily buy? You know, are they inexpensive items? So some people do not have, unfortunately, a lot of funds to throw everything away and replace it with new things. But there's a way in which we can kind of weigh the items. You know, is it an item that's highly porous and maybe easily, maybe less expensive that we could easily replace? So some of like clothing, for instance. So that might be an option where we decide to not take the clothing with us and just discard that and buy new. Couches, any type of furniture that's porous besides hard wood, that would be something that would have to be determined. Is it something I can afford to discard and then buy again, or should I consider remediating it? So I have some handouts on this.
Perfect. That's great. I love that you have handouts.
It's a huge topic, but it is a really important topic, because a lot of people really get stressed out about that. They say, I have to throw everything away now that I'm moving. Well, yes and no. It really does depend on the item.
Yeah, because you don't want to bring those spores with you. I know of another situation where a family had mold exposure. They didn't know about that. They brought everything, houseplants, baskets, mattress to another person's home. And then that person now has a mold problem.
Yep. So yes, and that can happen.
Not fun. So just being aware of that. But I'm so glad you have a handout because this stuff is really challenging to navigate. My last question is about washing machines because I know washing machines can be another place where mold can grow. I know when we moved into our new house, I did a ton of research because I know top loaders seem to be better. However, I really wanted a front loader and a bunch of front loaders were sued because of their mold growth.
Yes.
So a bunch of companies have taken steps to try to fix that. And I know the one that we ended up on was the GE Microban washer, which basically has a fan in the front when you're done washing that runs for like 3 hours and it pulls air in and basically blow dries the whole washer. And so far, it's been almost a year. We've had no mold growth on our front loader with that technology and that feature. But I could see how if you didn't have that and you just had a normal front loader, even leaving the door open, it still grows mold in the lip. And that can be a source, right? Yep.
Absolutely. I have a normal front loader, LG. I don't have the Microban. I did look at that one though. I liked that one. So what I do to prevent that from happening, and it is an extra step. So it is, you know, something else we have to think about. When I'm done washing for the day, I will leave the door open, but I will also dry the inside of that lip with a towel and make sure it's completely dry. If you have a vent in your laundry room, even better, because you can actually run that vent when you are using your washer and after. You can, you can have that going usually during and then 30 minutes after you're done as well, running that vent for about 30 minutes. But even leaving the drawer open where you put the soap, because that could be another place that harbors mold. So just keep that in mind, that sliding drawer where you add your soap. So you want to leave that open. You want to make sure that's dry as well as the lip. So leaving door open, drying everything should prevent that from happening. You can also clean the lip of that every week. You know, if you want to wipe that out, you can use some vinegar water, just cleaning that out again and then drying it when you're done should prevent the mold. So far, it's worked for me.
Yeah. I'm curious why you didn't choose the Microban one.
So the idea of it running for 3 hours, the electricity was one of the things that I was thinking about too. I don't know about if there's any type of chemical exposure with that Microban. I've read some of that somewhere that there could be some because of the plastic component to that and the Microban that's being used, if there's any type of VOC being off-gassed into the air. I don't know.
But that's just in it's just in the lip part.
Correct. And just in the lip. Yeah. So, So I don't know. But the thing that the reason I chose was I thought, well, okay, if I can leave it open, dry it out, I don't have a vent, unfortunately, in my laundry room. I wish I did. Then I should be okay as opposed to leaving that fan running for 3 hours. Now, I don't know how much electricity it really uses, but
yeah, I don't know either. I know. That's good. You're very good and conscious of the energy. We moved to Idaho so that we didn't have to think about it.
I think it's an amazing washer, though. I mean, I really do.
But I'm very impressed. I'm very impressed with it because I know with patients and with personal people, that has been a big source of mold exposure. And a lot of people are like, oh, it's fine. And it's like, well, I mean, you're literally exposed to that every day and it can grow really crazy mold in the lips of those washers. So that's another place to think about. And, you know, if you're going to buy new, maybe think about these new practices, or if you're lazy like me, get the Microban one.
The Microban's great. I think it is. I mean, I think for somebody that has a very busy lifestyle, if you don't have time to go in and wipe it out, you know, you don't have time to do those extra steps, then yes, that would be a great choice.
Yeah. Cool. Amazing. Is there anything else that you want to say about mold that we haven't talked about? There was so much that you shared, which is awesome.
So much. I do want to provide, I'll provide some of these resources. There's a documentary that's pretty cool called Moldy Movie.
Cool. I like that.
Yeah. From Dave Asprey. There's a couple books that I found to be really helpful. And then there's some websites that are also really helpful too. And then I'll provide some handouts about, you know, when hiring an environmental professional or remediation company, a fact sheet, how to find mold when you're buying or renting, and 10 questions about how to find a qualified mold inspector. So I have all those there.
I feel like you just need to put that all in a course. So then do that. So how can people find you? Can people work with you? Are you taking on patients, clients? Like, tell us all about that.
I am in a very limited capacity right now because I have my two babies and 3-year-old and 1-year-old. So they keep me busy. But my website is a good place to connect with me, and you can email me there. I'm on Instagram, but not a whole lot. Probably my website would be the best place to contact me.
Oh, Leslie, you need to make a course, because then you can just sell this course, you know, without having to do anything, you know, when your babies are sleeping or whatever. Because this is so valuable. True. You've taken so much time to gather all these resources, learn everything that you know, have all your clinical experience. It's so valuable. So we'll figure out a way to help you do that someday. In the meantime, we will link everything that you've mentioned in the show notes. Thank you so much for sharing all of your wisdom and knowledge.
You're
amazing. And I know we're going to have you on for a future episode in the future. So look forward to that.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Before you go, there's one last thing. Did you know that we have a swag store now? The Healthy as a Mother store, where we sell amazing merchandise that is fun to wear. We have shirts and hats and sweatshirts. We have drinkware, bags, journals, all of the things that are healthy as a mother or related to motherhood in general. We would love if you could support our podcast by checking out our store. We love doing what we do, and it's really helpful to get the support and also to spread the word and share our amazing brand with the world. And you get some really cool, awesome stuff. One of my favorites is the crop sweatshirt and one of our glasses that we sell that says Healthy as a Mother. I just think it's so great. So head to www.healthyasamother.com/store to check out what we have. Again, that is healthyasamother.com/store. And we are absolutely open to feedback. If there's something you would like to see that is not at the store, we can make a lot of different things there. So head over there, check it out, and we would love to see you sporting some Healthy as a Mother gear. And if you take a picture of yourself on Instagram, definitely tag Dr. Morgan and I, and we will be sure to share. Again, that is healthyasamother.com/store to check out our merchandise.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Healthy as a Mother podcast. In order for others to hear this information, please leave a review with Apple Podcasts, subscribe, and send to a friend who could benefit from this content. We're so excited to share more on becoming and being a mother next time.
And please remember that the ideas and views of this podcast are for informational purposes only and are not intended to serve as a substitute for medical care of any kind, including the diagnosis or treatment of any illness or disease. Consult with your provider before integrating this information into your own care plan. And remember, a healthier future starts now, and it starts with you.